Advanced Studio Classroom is on the air. Frank Gehry, he not only created some of the most interesting designs, he also impacted the whole industry of architecture. Join us as we discuss. Hello, friends. Welcome to Advanced Studio Classroom. I'm Campbell, and in the studio with me, I have my good friend, Peter. Hello, Peter.
Hello, Campbell. Hello, everyone. Nice to be here.
All right. So what are we talking about today, Peter, in this article?
Oh, we are talking about one of the great American architects, Frank Gehry, who passed just this past December. And the article is about partly his buildings, his marvelous constructions, but also about how he played a role in developing technology in the field of architecture.
Yeah. So what's really interesting about him is, yes, his designs were incredible and absolutely breathtaking and memorable, but we're not just talking about his designs, are we?
Right, yeah. No, his designs and how they came to be, because as you can see just by looking at the photographs in your magazine here for the article, his designs were wild. They were not just your typical building, which is basically square or rectangle in shape, triangle at most. Gehry's designs often look like just they go every which way.
Right.
And what is interesting in this article, it says from the title, from hand-drawn to high-tech, is learning about how he helped develop the technology to make these buildings possible because, in a way that without the technology, they might never have truly been realized because they were so different. They were so asymmetrical, as we say, a square, you know, has four sides and a corner. But a Gehry building has a corner here, a corner there, and a side here, and a side there.
And sometimes no corners.
And sometimes no corners at all, right. So it is not symmetrical. It is asymmetrical.
Right, which is incredible, you know. And we see a picture of Frank Gehry here on page 41, and it shows that he was born in 1929, and as Peter said, he just passed away recently, so he was probably about 94 or so when he passed away. So he lived a long life. But you can imagine from, 1929 and to 2025, technology
It's changed a bit.
It's changed a bit, to put it lightly, right? And so, to see the shift and how he was able to shift and move along with technology and then incorporate technology into his designs and into the buildings that he created, right? So it's a very interesting story. We've been building it up. So let's get into the article and then we can discuss further. Join us at the top of page 40.
From hand-drawn to high-tech. The analog mind that pushed architecture into the digital age. For an architect whose name and work have become known all over the world, Frank Gehry's buildings are about as far from the mainstream as one can get. Bent, curved, and clad in shiny metal, the most famous buildings by Gehry, who died last December, are also the most improbable. Coming up with the flamboyant designs for landmark buildings like the Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao and the Walt Disney Concert Hall in Los Angeles was only part of what made Gehry one of the most successful and celebrated architects in American history. Just as impressive are the ways Gehry helped explore and expand the architecture technologies used to actually build those swooping designs.
From hand-drawn to high tech. So as we talked about, he was born in 1920, Frank Gehry. 1929, apologies, yes. 1929. So pre-computers.
Pre-computers, pre-transatlantic flights, I believe. Pre-atomic energy, of course. Mm-hmm. Pre-space travel, pre a lot of things.
Yeah, actually a few years younger than Doris.
I believe you're right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So back then, when he started out, I did some research. He started his he started being an architect in the 1950s. Mm. So back then, it was a lot of paper and cardboard and actually physical models, right? And that's what we're referring to by this analog, right? It's, you know, that deck here says the analog mind that pushed architecture into the digital age. So it's this kind of interesting comparison, right? When we're talking about analog, we're talking about paper, we're talking about drawing, and, you know, there's this description of him crumpling up paper and ripping things up. And back then, when they built models of buildings, it would actually be physical cardboard cutout things, yeah. You know? But, you know, he shifted from that into the digital age. So more computer modeling, digital models, and things like that.
Right, yeah. And that's a good description of the word analog, too. Cardboard, paper, things that you do with your hands, as compared to digital, which is all keyboards and screens and the internet and such.
Right. So Frank Gehry is an architect whose name and work have become known all over the world. So he created some of the most famous buildings in the world. And we have some of the photos of his designs in this article. What's one word that kind of comes to mind when you look at his designs here?
Right. Well, to be honest, it is a word that the article uses as well, and that word is improbable. Mm-hmm. Improbable can have a couple meanings. Can mean, you know, in a literal sense, something that is improbable, is not probable. It defies the odds of happening, like for this very low-level sports team to beat the champions was improbable. But here, improbable means more surprising and slightly strange and very different, unlikely.
Yeah, they seem like they shouldn't even be able to exist in some ways, right?
Yeah.
They're very fantastical, and we have a description here. It says that his buildings tend to be bent, curved, and clad in shiny metal, right? So if you look at the designs, very often his buildings are round. There's not many straight edges.
Right. He doesn't just go for the rectangles and the squares.
Right. And beyond that, they're clad in shiny metal, meaning that the outside, it's not traditional stone or brick or mortar. It's more metal.
Right, right. If we could talk about buildings having clothing, then Gehry's buildings are clothed. They are clad in shiny metal.
Right. And this is kind of how what he's known for. Right, what he's famous for. And we have the word here, flamboyant, which is an interesting word. Flamboyant just means that it's brightly colored and easily noticed. I think of, you know, we're both actors, right?
Yeah.
We have flamboyant costumes or flamboyant designs, you know, basically very flashy.
Yes, the theater itself, in fact, often draws flamboyant personalities to it.
Yeah. So coming up with the flamboyant designs for landmark buildings, meaning buildings that are famous that people kind of just look at and they say, okay, that is a distinctive marker. People often maybe use that to give directions, right? It's a landmark. Buildings like the Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao and the Walt Disney Concert Hall in Los Angeles was only part of what made Gehry one of the most successful and celebrated architects in American history. Now, we see pictures of these buildings here at the top of page 40. That's the Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao, Spain. So we see the metal, we see the curved architecture, right? And then the Walt Disney Concert Hall is on page 42. Again, the metal and the curved designs, right? Now, these buildings are iconic, is another word I would use. Iconic. And one of the reasons why he was celebrated as one of the most successful and best architects in American history. But there's another reason. What is the other reason?
Right. Well, this is very interesting. I personally didn't know about this. I mean, I'm not a big architecture fan, but I had a general sense. I'd seen pictures of his buildings, and I sort of knew Frank Gehry is the one who creates those weird-shaped buildings. But I had no idea, as it says here, that Gehry also helped to explore and expand architecture technologies that were used to build these swooping designs, as the author puts it, swooping. You think of a bird up high in the sky, and then it sees some prey, something it wants, and it dives very quickly down from the sky, but in a smooth, curving manner the way birds do. Mm-hmm. That's a swoop. And for a building, you know, buildings obviously don't fly like birds, but the lines of the building do. I mean, you look at the Bilbao Museum there, and you see those huge curving lines throughout mm-hmm. the building. Those can also be referred to as swoops or a swooping design.
Yeah, I think that's a very good way to describe his designs. They're swooping. They curve in and out and up and down. Very few flat edges to his designs. Now, so what we're saying here is that not only are the buildings impressive, but what's also impressive is that he helped to create or develop technology for these buildings to exist, right?
Exactly.
And these technologies ended up impacting the whole field of architecture.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. But what's interesting and what's more impressive is that he himself, as we started out talking, he's an analog person, right? He's not as familiar with computers. He doesn't know computers that well. But yet he was able to use technology to create these buildings, right? So how did that happen? Let's continue our article and we can learn more about this pioneer.
Pioneer. Gehry worked for decades to advance new technologies that radically changed how architects work. Despite claiming a near incomprehension of computers, Gehry was one of the earliest architects to experiment with and embrace computer-aided design approaches, like digitizing designs from concept to construction through building information modeling, BIM. These are now standard practices in the world of architecture. But when Gehry and his firm started applying these approaches, it was uncharted territory. The breakthrough for Gehry came after his firm won a commission to design a large pavilion for the 1992 Olympics in Barcelona. Gehry, a sculptor at heart, designed a massive abstract fish to be built using stainless steel mesh panels. Translating the design concept into a buildable set of two-dimensional blueprints proved complicated. A contractor tried to build a mock-up of the project six times, but couldn't get it right. So Gehry's team found a solution in a software tool developed by an aerospace manufacturer. Creating an advanced 3D model of the project allowed Gehry and his firm to more clearly communicate the precise shapes and curves of his design to the builders and contractors on the construction site. The project was completed on time and on budget.
All right, so what's really interesting, as we've been talking about, is Gehry, while he helped to develop all these technologies, he himself wasn't a person that really knew a lot about computers.
Right, yeah, which really is fascinating. And you can't blame the guy, really. He was born in 1929, as we've said. He didn't grow up with smartphones, much less computers at all. So many things that we take for granted were brand new to him and came to them later in life. But these technologies, nevertheless, radically changed how architects works. Radically means, you know, very greatly changed. And it goes on to say that despite claiming a near incomprehension of computers, that is to say, he stated that he virtually did not understand computers. He could not comprehend them. He had a near incomprehension of computers. Geary was one of the earliest architects to experiment with and embrace computer-aided design approaches. So just an interesting nuance there. It wasn't that Geary was secretly this computer genius who just one day said, hey, I should use computers to help build my buildings. No, he was experimenting. He was an architect who experimented with computer-aided designs. But then, a few words later, it says he went on to embrace computer-aided design approaches. Mm-hmm. Embrace, that's another word for like when you hug someone, when you draw someone or something very close to you. You don't hold it at arm's length. You don't just use it sometimes. You embrace it. You use it fully and often.
Yeah. Now, I have to imagine that he probably had a really great team around him, right?
Yes.
As someone who doesn't understand computers, for him to be able to embrace technology and computers, I think you would need to have a really great team, which I think then speaks to his leadership.
Yes.
Right? And his willingness to work with others and maybe not be the smartest person in the room.
Yes.
You know, and I feel like that's a good sign of a great leader. Yeah. And so he not only pushed architecture in terms of his designs, he also pushed architecture in terms of technology, right? And that's kind of what we're talking about in this article. Now, we have an interesting term here, building information modeling, BIM, and it'll come back again later in this article. What are we referring to when we're talking about BIM?
Right. Well, as it says, building information modeling. And personally, I did not look this up before we began the article. Maybe you have a little more information on it, but it appears to be how a building that you want to make is modeled first. Like we were saying earlier, in the old days, it was with cardboard, paper, and construction, that sort of thing, a model of the building before you actually built the thing. And presumably now, as a result of Geary's pioneering of computer approaches to the work, architects are able to model buildings digitally.
Mm-hmm. Right. So pre-computers, everything was done on paper. We talk about the blueprints, right? We often talk about blueprints in architecture. It's basically a piece of paper with the design, okay? Now, post-computers, all of that is digitized. It's put on the computer, but it's not just another picture of the building or a design of the building. It's actually a database, right?
Mm.
It's a database which includes everything that is going to go into the building, including all the different, you know, nuts and bolts and the nails and just the siding and the materials. And it's just a database so that they can actually calculate with precision, you know, how big is this wall and the nail and how thick the wall needs to be. It's basically a way to organize all the information that goes into building a building. Right. And so each object knows how big it is, what material it's made from, how much it costs, how it's connected to other parts, when it gets installed.
Mm.
And, you know, and there's a lot of details that goes into a building.
Sure, sure.
Right. You know, what goes up first, what goes up next. And this basically, this BIM is a database. And it just basically is able to organize all the information. So it's not just a piece of paper with a picture on it.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Now, when Geary and his team started using BIM and things like this, this was really new. But these are now standard practices. This is now something that most companies, most architectural firms actually use and apply. But when Geary and his firm started, this was uncharted territory. That's an interesting phrase.
Yeah, no, I love that one. Uncharted territory. And like we've basically said, it means new, unexplored territory. We say uncharted territory. It refers back to, Middle Ages, in the West at least, when ships explored the world using maps. Another word for maps is charts. So if something was uncharted, it meant there was no map for it, or the map for it was incomplete. And so for a ship to, or for a team of explorers in a new land to explore territory that there was no map for, we would call it unmapped or uncharted territory.
Right. So his firm was, in essence, one of the first to adopt this new technology, which is why we called him a pioneer. A pioneer is someone who explores a new land or heads out first or does something first. They are the pioneer. Now, he didn't start off using this technology. Like we said, he started in the 1950s. This technology didn't exist, right? But when did he start using this technology, and what was it that caused him to start using this technology?
Right. Well, he began using it, the article says, around 1992. When his firm received a commission to design a large pavilion for the Olympics being held in Barcelona that year, Barcelona, Spain. A commission is basically a contract, an agreement to do something, usually in an artistic field, like architecture. And a pavilion, a large pavilion. Pavilion is, it's a little hard to describe, but it's basically an open space used for a particular activity and with some kind of roofing or covering over it, but not so that it creates an indoor space like a house does, because a house has a roof over it. Right. But a pavilion is like a house without walls, but with a roof, basically speaking.
Yeah.
And so they wanted, it's for public events like an Olympics. You might hold a reception there. You might hold an outdoor flea market there, a market bazaar of some sort. Mm-hmm. And so for the Olympics, obviously, there's a lot of ceremonies that go on, and they wanted a nice pavilion for the Olympics. So they commissioned Gary's firm to make it. And he designed this massive abstract fish, an abstract thing meaning something that is unconventional, not immediately recognizable from reality, using stainless steel mesh panels.
Yeah, and we see a picture of this fish on page 41. It does, you can see it kind of looks like a fish, but it's not like, it's
not,
abstract.
Not a particular fish, like, oh, that's a dolphin, or oh, that's a minnow or something.
Yes, yes. So you can see the shape of a fish, but it's not, you know, a very distinct fish. Right. And so this is an interesting design. Okay. And there's a phrase here. It says he's a sculptor at heart. I love that. Just means he's an architect, but in his heart of hearts, he is a sculptor. He's an artist.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is very telling, because that is, I think, largely why, I mean, just from the little I know of him, that is largely why I think his buildings look the way they do. Mm-hmm. Because like we've been saying, he doesn't make these general conventional buildings that are basically square or rectangular shaped, because that's not how a sculptor thinks.
Right.
A sculptor doesn't think in terms of practicality.
Yeah.
A sculptor thinks in terms of artistic ideas and expression and abstraction and such. So, yeah, to learn that he was a sculptor at heart, I think you definitely see that in his architectural work.
Yeah, and you use the word practicality. I think that's a very good way to describe it. You know, his buildings weren't practical, and he wasn't bound by practical ideas.
Right.
You know, in fact, it was because his buildings weren't practical that it kind of pushed him to need to use technology, right? And that's what we see in this next sentence. It says, translating the design concept into a buildable set of two-dimensional blueprints proved complicated, right? So again, in the early days, they did everything on paper. It was two-dimensional. But then to be able to explain, you know, what the dimensions of this fish are and how to curve it and the basically, you know, the curvature and the angle and all that stuff, it's hard to do on this two-dimensional piece of paper.
Right.
So they needed a different way, right? And so they tried to tell a contractor how to build it. The guy did it six times.
Right, right. He built a mock-up of the project six times. A mock-up just means a full-size model of something made before the real thing is built. Like the models we were talking about earlier, you could refer to the of paper and cardboard. You could refer to those as mock-ups.
Mm-hmm. Now, I wonder if it was a full-size here, because that would be a huge...
That would be enormous. That would take up a couple rooms. Yeah, I imagine maybe a little smaller.
Right, right. Maybe to scale, right?
Yes.
Maybe a model to scale, like we talked about, you know, maybe a cardboard or something model back then. But he couldn't get it right. He didn't quite get it the way Gary wanted it to be. So they needed to find a solution. And what was that solution?
The solution was a software tool that had been developed by an aerospace manufacturer.
Well, so, what is an aerospace manufacturer?
Yeah, that is... Aerospace can cover a lot of things, but basically it means builder of airplanes or builder of rocket ships or related machinery and technology in that field of aerospace. And so they had created this for their work in aerospace, and Gary somehow found out about it and wondered if it could be used for architecture to help explain by creating a 3D model, 3D, of course, meaning three-dimensional model of the project in order to communicate all those shapes and curves and swoops of his design of the fish to the builders and contractors on the site.
Right, and that kind of makes sense, right? Because when we're talking about, you know, airplanes and rockets, they're round and they have similar shape.
Yeah.
Actually, you know, in some ways, this fish does look a little bit like an airplane, like a curved airplane.
Sure, sure.
In some ways. So he's basically using technology that they use to design and build airplanes, and now he's applying it to his... fish.
Right, right. Not to design the fish, but to communicate the design, to make it more understandable to the guys who are actually going to be building it in real life.
Yes. And this resulted in the project being completed on time and on budget, which is in some ways a miracle.
I would say so, yes.
Because, you know, one of the most infamous things about buildings are the fact that, you know, it's always, there's always delays.
Yeah.
And there's always, you're always over budget.
Right. They're big undertakings.
Yeah. All right. Well, we have a lot more to discuss about Frank Gehry. So please come back and join us for day two of this article. We hope that you have enjoyed the discussion so far. I definitely have. And Peter, thank you for your insights.
Oh, yes.
Until then, we'll see you tomorrow. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.